point out, everyone is here for transfer methods and signal processing, I hope. Here is a very crude outline of the course. What we're going to talk about, what we're going to go over. You know, the times here are pretty rough, and it will depend a little bit on how we go in terms of, you know, questions and things like that, whether I go quickly. There's a lot of material here in these lecture notes. Frankly, I don't think the math is hard. I think you can do this course with second year math, a little bit of calculus. You don't even really have to know too many D's. You need to know how to integrate, basically. So the math is not hard here, but we're going to go through things fairly fast a lot of the time. So feel free to slow me down if you're having problems. But I'm generally going to go reasonably fast. The goal is for us to get to wavelets. So, you know, you could almost call this course a brief tour leading up to wavelets, something along those lines. All of this material is really to teach you enough stuff so that I can teach you about wavelets. I think wavelets are really interesting. I think they're a very powerful technique for doing a whole bunch of things. And so it's a really useful thing for us to learn about. On the way, we're going to learn about a whole lot of applications and so on of these various other techniques as well. This is a crude outline. There's a much more detailed outline on the web page. You're welcome to go and have a look at that if you're interested. Again, your four books that I've got as references. I've got four books here because they each cover different aspects with sort of different degree of focus. Bracewell, I guess, is really a really nice book about Fourier transforms and a bunch of related transforms. But I don't find it very good when you start talking about practical signal processing. If you want the more practical side of signal processing, then one of these two books is probably a better start. And of course, none of those three really cover wavelets in any sufficient degree. This book by Stéphane Nalat is really, you know, I think of it as, you know, one of the key books in the wavelet area. It's not a fun book to read, though. So I don't suggest you pick it up today and try and read it. I suggest you use it to try and understand some things if you're having trouble when I get to that part of the lecture course. Online material. So I'm going to give you a CD, which is going to have all of this stuff on it. But from time to time, I update the lecture notes. From time to time, I find little mistakes in them, or you find mistakes in them, and I will go away and correct them. Now, I can't correct your CD once I've given it to you, so that's a bit unfortunate. But if you take your CD and you look at it, the stuff that's on your CD will be in exactly the same format as the stuff that's on the internet. And so it'll be very easy for you to download the appropriate document and fill in the gap that you might have in your work. We've got one person turning up late already. What's that? If you want a printed set of, I'm going to give you a CD. If you want a printed set of notes, write your name down there, but it will be $10. The other thing that I'll put up on the web page is the class exercises and the class exercise solutions and so on. You know, if there's any sort of extra information or extra materials that come up through the course, I'll put them up there as well. The idea is to have them in the same format as the CD you're handing out. It's not, I repeat that, it's not on my uni. There is nothing on my uni for this course. There are a couple of reasons for that. One is I have subjects from all over the university doing this course. The other one is that I like to have the materials in the same format as the CD. It's very hard for me to do that with my uni, whereas if I set up my own web page, I can just basically copy what's on the web page onto a CD, and you get the CD, and that way you get everything very easily. Okay, enough of the administrative material. We have a little joke for you. Man camped in a national park, noticed Mr. Snake and Mrs. Snake slithering by, and he said, "Where are all the little snakes?" And Mr. Snake replied, we're others, so we can't multiply. The following year, he returned to the same camping spot, but this time there were a whole lot of little snakes. And the man says, well, I thought you said you couldn't multiply, he said. And the snake replies, well, the park ranger came by and built a log table, so now we can multiply by adding. So this is a joke that probably makes more sense if you get taught log tables in school. How many people were taught log tables in school? Okay. So no one was taught. So let's just test this. How many people weren't taught log tables in school? Put your hand up. How many people were taught log tables in school? So this is an either-or question. You have to put your hand up for one of those two answers. Let's try this again. How many people were taught log tables in school? How many people weren't taught log tables in school? Now I can see this group here, you have to put your hand up for one of these. This is a simple question designed to try and get you it's designed to elicit a response. Frankly, I think the only reason they taught me log tables in school was as a sort of obscure punishment, because people had learnt log tables themselves. Log tables are not a great deal of fun. These days you use a calculator to do multiplication. The point is that you can exploit the simple relationship with log functions. Simple relationship where the log of a product is the sum of the logs. Why is this useful? Well, if I go away and I look up these two numbers, log A and log B, in this big book of tables, then I just have to do addition. I don't have to do multiplication. So what if I have two big complicated numbers, you know, six digit numbers that I want to multiply? Instead of having to do some very complicated arithmetic for multiplication, I just look up the logs, add the logs, and then do an inverse log operation, and I can work out the product. This is how a slide rule works. This is what a slide rule does. Engineers used to use slide rules for just about everything. And it's a very, very powerful way of doing a certain set of operations. Of course, we don't need it these days because of calculators. Doesn't obviate the fact that this sort of transform is very useful. The idea here is that by taking some sort of transformation, we make it easier for ourselves to do an operation. There's no new information when we do this. It doesn't change the information here. The information content is exactly the same. It just makes our life easier. That's what transforms are really about. The sort of transforms we're going to be talking about are not quite so simple. They're integral transforms. So they're a little bit more complicated than this. The classic one is the Fourier transform, which transforms from the time domain to the frequency domain. The same information will be present though, just more accessible in one form than the other. What are the applications for this? Well, signal and image processing are the ones we're going to talk about primarily here. There are applications in just about every area of science. I have a whole bunch of them listed here. We may touch on a few of these sort of applications from time to time, but the range of applications is really extraordinary for this sort of technique. In signal processing, there's a really wide range of applications. Up the top, I have internet traffic analysis. The reason I have that at the top is because that's one of my research areas. It's something I'm particularly interested in. One of the things you might want to do is detect denial of service attacks, DOS attacks. You can do this by doing traffic analysis, by looking at the traffic on your network and trying to understand that as a signal. And we can do that using these sort of transform techniques I'm going to talk about. Music generation analysis, always a bit of fun trying to understand music, trying to understand signals. I'm going to use this sort of thing as a couple of examples as we go along. I apologize for my completely hopeless knowledge of music though, so anyone out there who's a good musician will probably find a lot of mistakes if they look carefully at what I'm going to say about this. But certainly there is a great deal of analysis that we can do using things like Fourier transforms when we look at music. Biomedical engineering is a classic one. Things like CAT, MRI scans, these are really signal processing techniques. Understanding ECGs, electrocardiograms, this requires signal processing. Signal processing is used in a whole range of biomedical applications. It's a very important technique in that area. Image processing is another classic one, and the reason I want to talk a bit about image processing here is because it gets us into a bit of 2D signal processing. Rather than just looking at 1D signals all the time, we get to look at some images which are two-dimensional and which look pretty on the screen, so that will give us something to do in that sort of regard. And we have a whole bunch of, I'll talk a bit more about applications in a second. What we're going to be talking about is not things like the log function, that's a bit too simple for a fourth year course. We're going to be talking about integral transforms. What do I mean by an integral transform, I hear you ask? Did I hear anyone ask that? No. Okay. We're going to take a function, and we're going to transform it by integrating it with multiplied by another function here, this g. We're going to call this function g a kernel function, and you notice that g is a function not just of t, the thing we're integrating with, it's also a function of s. So what this does is it transforms from a space where we have a function of t into this integral, but this big integral thing is a function of s. So typically this t would be something like time, and s would be something like frequency. That's what the Fourier transform does. It transforms from the time domain to the frequency domain. There are many different ways of writing this in terms of notation. The sort of full form of it, we're doing a transform of this function of t, and the value that we're going to use when we transform is s, and this is this integral here. People rarely write this sort of full form of transform. They usually use some sort of abbreviation. So simple abbreviations might be, if you're transforming little f of t, the transform we will call big F of s. Another way you might write it is to have a sort of little cursive f as your transform, or to put a little symbol over the top of the f when you do the transform. These are all standard sorts of notation. There are other forms of notation that get used from time to time as well. So I'm going to vary the notation that I use as I go through the lectures, partly just to familiarize you with that sort of notation. The different notations get used by different people indiscriminately, it seems, sometimes. Each person has their favorite notation, and so when you're reading a book or you're reading a paper or reading some sort of report, you have to be able to interpret that. One of the nice things about integral transforms is they're linear operators. What does a linear operator mean? Well, we take some sort of objects, f, and we apply an operator to them. That's what an operator is. A linear operator has the property that if we take a scalar multiple of our object plus a scalar multiple of another object, then the operator, when we apply to it, just goes through. We end up with the same linear operation on the operated version of f and h. So perhaps that wasn't particularly clear, but this is a fairly precise statement. This is what we mean by linearity. And we'll come across linearity in a few places in this course. The course is primarily going to be concerned with linear operators, linear systems, and so on. Pretty easy to prove that an integral transform is a linear operator. What are some examples? Okay, I have a bunch of examples here. The identity transform. The interesting thing about the identity transform is when you do the identity transform, you don't change the function. You get back your original function. So that's kind of boring. But it's there as a kind of case just for us to get our head around. The Fourier transform, we have a kernel function which is a complex exponential. So we take an integral of our function with this complex exponential and we get the Fourier transform. There's Laplace transforms, Hilbert, Mellon. I've really just included these for completeness. We're not going to talk much about these transforms in this course. Why is that? Well, we have a limited amount of time, and frankly, I don't use Hilbert and Mellon transforms. I don't really even know what they're useful for particularly, so I'm not going to try and tell you what they're useful for. That's probably a bit narrow-minded of me, but you're welcome to go and look these things up and tell me that I'm being narrow-minded and come back and tell me what I should be putting in the lectures next year, or even this year. The Fourier cosine we will be looking at a little bit is actually very closely related to the Fourier transform. So it's not hard for us to look at separately. It's pretty much the same set of properties and so on. The nice thing about the Fourier cosine transform is it's a real transform, whereas this involves complex numbers. So let's have a look at the Fourier transform. In fact, I'm cheating a little bit here. I'm actually doing discrete transforms and plotting graphs up for you. Please allow my little indulgence in doing that. You should get the idea nevertheless. So what have we got here? Well, at the top we have a sine wave. It's just a sine function. Standard thing you should have learned about probably in high school, I guess. And here we have its Fourier transform. Actually, we don't have its Fourier transform here. I'm telling you a little fib. What we have is its power spectrum, which is the square of the magnitude of the Fourier transform. And in most of these plots, I'll be showing you power spectrums. The problem is the Fourier transform itself is complex. And so I have to show you a real and imaginary part. I don't want to do that just at the moment, so I'm showing you just the magnitude. Now, what's interesting about this, well, we have a sine wave here. That sine wave turns into a single spike in the frequency domain. This is the basic property of the Fourier transform that makes it so useful. It turns something complicated like this, well, not that complicated, not yet that complicated, into a nice single spike. Let's make it a bit more complicated. Let's add two sine waves together, two sine waves with different frequency. Now, this signal, you'll agree, looks a bit more complicated. It still doesn't look too bad, but, you know, it's got some wiggle up and down, some things going on. When we transform into the frequency domain, it's just two spikes. What about this one? If you just showed me that signal, and I looked at it, I'd probably say, well, that looks pretty random to me. That looks like a real mess. I have no idea what that is. Actually, it's just four sine waves mixed together. Only four. And already we have something that looks, as far as I can see, like a random signal. So this Fourier transform is letting us do something very powerful. It's letting us decompose those sinusoidal components. It's telling us where they are in that signal. It's giving us a view of the signal that we wouldn't have otherwise. There's no new information here, as I said. It's the same information. It's just being displayed in a way where we can understand it better. And this is really important. This is what the Fourier transform does. This is what transforms do in general. So here's a more practical example. Here's an ECG, an electrocardiogram. So if you've ever watched any of those hospital shows on TV, ER and, I don't know, people dying all over the place, people get attached to this machine and it has a little printout that looks like this going along and the machine goes beep every so often. What the machine is trying to do is give them an indication of the heart rate, which is an indication of the periodicity of this signal. Well, I look at that signal and I think, well, you know, it's got some fairly obvious spikes there. It'd be pretty easy for me to pick it out by hand. But how do I get a computer to do that? Can't put a little guy inside the box and get him to look at the signal and go beep every time he sees one of those lines. I have to work out an automated algorithm. In this case, it's pretty easy because these things are really obvious. But some ECGs are much noisier than this. You want a technique which will generically pull out that periodic behavior. Periodic behavior is what we see with this Fourier transform. So this is the power spectrum again, and you can see the periodic behavior is manifesting as a series of sine waves. We can use these to work out the period in the fundamental period in this heart rate, and we can use that to work out when to make our beeps, at least for the movie. Sound and waves are interesting. We're all fairly familiar with sound and waves in some form or another. I'm going to give you a trivial introduction to them here. For anyone who's done any physics at all, or probably most engineers, this will be fairly trivial, I imagine. The basic idea of sound is it's a series of compression and rarefactions in the air, and these travel as a wave. The number of these compression-decompression sequences that you hear in some time unit gives you an idea of the periodicity in the wave, the frequency of that wave, if it's a simple enough wave. So if we have a simple wave where these have these compressions and then rarefactions, the time between them reaching your ear is the period. One on that period is the frequency of the oscillations. The wavelength is the velocity divided by the frequency. We don't really have to know about wavelengths here. We're not going to care about that. We care about the signal that we hear. So there's a few physical things about sound that are, you know, worth knowing, but they don't really matter to us so much as the characteristics of the sound when it gets to our ear or when it gets to a microphone. So let's think about that a little bit. I have a whole big bunch of frequencies up here for you. This is what we call the equal temperament musical scale. Daniel maybe correct me if I get anything too obviously wrong. So we have a bunch of notes. These are our conventional notes. They run from A to G. And these are the frequencies. You notice that for each note there's a series of frequencies. We call one of these sort of rows an octave. And you notice that as we go up an octave, the frequencies double. This is really strongly related to the physics of music. And I'll explain this in just a second. The interesting thing about this scale, you notice we have 12 notes along here. When we go from here to here, we're doubling. The equal temperament scale tries to spread these notes equally through this thing. Not equally, notice the difference here between this note and this note is not the same. The ratio of the notes is the same. Because we're doubling when we go up here, we want to have ratios that are same between these notes. The really interesting thing I found about this scale, this is the scale that we all listen to whenever you listen to music, almost certainly Western music. You hear this scale. Rock music, you hear this scale. You hear these frequencies. But it's not the only possible scale. And in fact, it's a relatively modern invention to use equal temperament in scales. So see, we have these 12 semitones, these 12 notes as we go up through the scale. Each octave doubles the frequency. We want to have equal spacing between these on a log scale, so the ratio should be the same. So if we go up by a factor of 2 with 12 notes, then the ratio between any of these two semitones should be the 12th root of this factor of 2. So if we take, say, the ratio of D sharp down here to D, we get 38.89 on 36.70. It's roughly 1.0595. Obviously, it's not a rational number, so you could extend it out a fair way. So, why is this important? Well, this is kind of interesting. The physics of music is got to line up with this somehow. The physics and the theory of music have to somehow connect together. So let me tell you a little bit about physics. Vibrating strings, in particular. Take a string and you vibrate it. Those of you who've done any physics, this is one of your classic sort of physics examples, I think, originally solved, or originally looked at way, way, way back in, say, the 17th century, but solved, I think, by one of the Bernoullis. And what he showed is that you can take this vibrating string and you can represent its vibrations as a mixture of harmonics. So imagine the string is vibrating and it just vibrated like this. The two endpoints are fixed, and the middle vibrates up and down. That's not the only way a string can vibrate. Another way, though, is these two bits go up and down, and the middle stays fixed as well. Or likewise, you can have three of these guys. So if you call this a node, you call these guys antinodes. The interesting thing about these is the frequency of these vibrations is different. The frequency of this vibration is 2 times the frequency of this vibration. The frequency of this is 3 times the frequency of this vibration. So if you take a string and you vibrate it, it will have some mixture of all of these vibration modes. And it will have 4 times F, 5 times F, and so on. We call these harmonics. We call this the fundamental note. We call these harmonics. So this would be our first harmonic, our second harmonic, and so on. So when we hear a string being plucked, we hear a whole mixture of these sounds. The Fourier transform gives us a way of working out something about this mixture. But one of the interesting things is when we start to try and align these harmonics up with the music scale, something kind of interesting happens. So imagine this is my string's fundamental. This is the note I'm going to play, an A on a string. Don't care what instrument you're playing. So these are my harmonics. So 440, 880, this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on, times the fundamental frequency. And what I've done is normalized it here back to this same octave. So let's have a think about it. 1320 is 2 times 660. So just brought it back down to 660 so that we can see it easily, see what note it is. The interesting thing is, if you look at the first harmonic, it's the same note. It's twice the frequency. That takes us up one octave. But the third harmonic isn't. The third harmonic corresponds to 660. That corresponds to an E. If we go back and have a look at this picture back here, let it go. So where are we? 660 is around here. You also notice that 660 is not 659.25. It's not spot on. So when I play a string that's got an A, I get a bunch of these notes coming out of it. You see that they're not all the same note, and they're not even, some of them are out by 1% away from the closest other note that they could be. What's that? So what I'm doing here is just scaling this guy back to the actual note. So say it's, there's one that's a bit out, 550. So here it's 554. I'm just taking the difference and looking at the relative value, okay? So there's an interesting result of this. Whenever we grow up listening to music. We grow up listening to musical devices like guitars and so on. These musical devices have things like strings or pipes which have these harmonics. Flutes, for instance, they have a pipe. Pipes have a similar sort of harmonic structure. So we get used to listening to harmonics. We get used to these sounds being together, this collection of notes being played together effectively. Because we don't ever hear this pure cosine, this pure sine sound. So when we play music, we start building musical structures that put these notes together. So the example that I know a little bit about is guitar chords. This is a little stylized picture of the neck of a guitar. So this is the top up near the keys. This is the first fret here, second fret, and so on. And these lines going down the page represent the six strings of the guitar. For those of you who haven't seen a guitar or know what they are, these strings are typically tuned. They don't have to be tuned, but they're typically tuned to these notes. And this picture shows you where to put your fingers on the guitar. So these, you know, guitarists look at charts of these, and you look at a big set of chord charts, and it's a book this thick, and it has, you know, 1,000 of these different arrangements of chords. Actually, you know, a lot of guitarists use three of them. So you can get by knowing very few guitar chords. Perhaps you shouldn't have to get by knowing that few. So what are we showing here? Well, the dots show you put your finger on that string. If there's no dot, you leave the string open. If there's a cross, don't play that string. So we can take this and we can work out the notes that are being played. And say the A string, it's open, so that means that when you play that string, you get an A. The D string, we're using the second fret. Each time you go up a fret, you go up one semitone. So that would be D, what are we doing? E flat, E. So that's where we get an E down here. Okay, so when we play this chord, we get a series of notes, which I've written down here. Lo and behold, let's go back and look here. We have A, E, C sharp, E. These first five are all A's, E's, or C sharps. That's interesting. That's exactly the notes we get here. Those first four or five harmonics tend to be the strongest when you play something like a string. They don't have to be, but they tend to be. So if those first five harmonics are really important, we tend to hear them together a lot. And this is how we form our major chords, by grouping these guys together. How do we get what we call a seventh chord? Well, we include the seventh harmonic in here. So we pull our seventh harmonic out, is a G, put a G into here, and we get an A7. So this is how people actually go about, when you get taught to play the guitar, they just tell you, this is an A, go and play it. They don't bother to tell you why it might sound nice to you. They don't tell you why other combinations of notes sound bad. Well, bad is a very subjective thing. They sound bad because they're not something that we've heard very much of. I bet if you took a kid and you raised them in isolation and you only ever played them some bizarre set of notes together, they would start regarding that as being what you would normally hear in music. So what's the point here? Well, I'm really going off on a bit of a digression here. The point that we're going to come back to is that this Fourier transform gives us a way of understanding what's going on here. You know, there's all these harmonics, there's all this mixture of frequencies in here. How are we going to actually take a signal like that and pull it apart and understand it? Well, we do a Fourier transform. So this is a cos wave. This is actually a little segment of a cosine wave that I've generated using MATLAB. And this is its Fourier transform. You can see one big spike here, which corresponds to the frequency of this cosine wave. You can see this particular one that I've drawn here is at about 110 Hz. I'm actually not going to play the 110 Hz one for you. I'm going to play 440. Why am I playing 440 instead of 110? Well, for some reason my Macintosh doesn't like playing 110. Okay. Does that sound like music to anyone? Certainly doesn't sound like music to me. It sounds very, very artificial. Doesn't sound like anything that we ever listen to. That's because the music we listen to has a whole bunch of other things mixed in our harmonics. So let's have a look at something that's a bit more real. It's just a single pluck of a guitar string. And you can see that that's a much more rich sound. When I say rich, I'm talking about a tone or timbre. And what we really mean is it's not just a simple cosine. It's got a whole bunch of other stuff mixed in there, a whole bunch of harmonics. And those harmonics, when we look at the Fourier transform, we can see them. Again, I think this is the fundamental here, and you can see a whole bunch of harmonics. You can also see some other frequencies cropping up around the place, because there's some weird things that go on in guitars, because it's not just the string vibrating. You also have a soundboard. The soundboard is what you actually hear. The string, if you just play a string by itself, is very quiet. The soundboard acts as an amplifier. The soundboard has a whole bunch of different frequencies it can vibrate at, not just the same simple ones that we have when we look at a string. So that complicates things a lot. But you can see fundamental coming out pretty clearly here. You can see a bunch of other tones in here. But one of the things that you'll notice if you listen to this carefully let's try this again listen to this carefully it changes over time. Why does it change over time? Well, these vibrations involve different amounts of energy, they involve different sort of frictional issues and so on, so they die away at different rates. When you play a guitar string, you start with a whole bunch of these harmonics, and then they die away, and they die away at different rates. The note itself is a transient thing. One of the things that we're going to come across in this course is the fact that the Fourier transform doesn't really deal with transients. The Fourier transform looks at a signal and it just pulls it apart in one big piece. It says, what are the frequencies in that signal? So I've gone from this time domain to the frequency domain, and when I look at this, I've lost any notion of time. It's all gone out the window here. This is where things like wavelets come in. What wavelets let you do is preserve some of the temporal information and some of the frequency information and get a sort of dual view of your signals. So I'm not going to try and tell you about wavelets in this lecture. What I'm going to do is give you a thing called a spectrogram, which is a kind of crude form of this sort of wavelet analysis. And here, what I have along the y-axis is frequency. So you think of this as my Fourier transform axis, and along this axis I have time. And this is the same guitar plot. These red lines indicate red values are lots of power, blue means not much power at all, dark blue means, or black means no power, lighter blue means a bit more power, yellow is somewhere in between, and then red is really, really lots of power. So you can see we have our fundamental down here somewhere. Then we have a series of harmonics, and you notice how the harmonics are evenly spaced. We go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 multiples of our fundamental. We also have a very sharp start here. That's because you pluck a string, it suddenly starts. It's not something that's been around forever. And you also see these guys decay away, and the higher harmonics sort of seem to be decaying away a bit faster than some of these low harmonics down here. And so this alters the tone of the note as the note progresses. I have another example here. This is a little clip of actual music. Let's just play it. Ooh, we started halfway through there. Start again. So I like this piece of music as an illustration of some of these sort of ideas, because it has a range of different sounds in it. It starts out with these sort of very mechanical sorts of sound. And you can see this signal, you can see them happening here. There's some periodicity, there's a lot of stuff happening. So sort of around here, and then we get to this bit, and then it breaks into more traditional sort of sounding music. So you can sort of see some of that happening when you look at the signal. But you can't really tell what's going on. When we look at the spectrogram, you get a much better idea of what's going on here. Let's try it again. So these first sounds, they don't have much musical content. There's not much structure in this spectrum yet. There's this periodic bursts of noise, but there's not much structure there. There's this sort of very noisy mechanical sorts of sound. Then we break into voice and music, and suddenly you see these structured lines going across here, this series of harmonics. You can tell that music's being played again, and if you're clever enough, you could probably actually work out what the notes are. So there's an interesting problem out there, which is automated transcription of music, where you have a computer try and take a piece of music and work out what the notes are in that. Actually, it turns out to be an extremely hard problem to solve. There are a whole bunch of little issues that you have to get right if you want to do automatic transcription, particularly if you want to transcribe voice, where people do all sorts of funny things to their voice. Our voice has very, very rich sort of structure in it, and we have very good control over that structure, particularly good singers. How are you going? We'll have a break in just a second, but I want to give you one more little example. What I've been talking so far about is analysis. But the Fourier transform doesn't just let us analyze sounds, it lets us do things to them as well. And this is really powerful. So one of the classic things people want to be able to do these days is change someone's voice. So the examples that you might have seen of this are, for instance, when you have an interview with someone, an anonymous person, they don't want their voice to be recognized on TV. So they put the voice through some process which is going to change the sound of that voice. A very simple way of doing that is to change the frequencies in that voice, because we're really key to those things. You take the frequencies and you change them. For instance, women have much higher pitched voices. So if you take a woman's voice and you make it higher pitched, you can almost make it sound like a man's talking. And this gives you a good way of anonymizing someone on the TV. Another classic sort of example that people want to use is for transcribing music again. You know, I've just said that automated transcription is fairly hard. People are fairly good at it. Good musicians can sit down and they can just work out what the notes were by listening. In fact, there's a story about Mozart. What is it? There's a piece of music called the Misère by Allegri, which is a really beautiful sort of piece of church music. I'll play it next week. I'll bring it along to the next lecture and play it. And in the, I don't know, about 16th century, I think it was written. Is that right? And for something like 100 years, it was only ever allowed to be played in the Vatican at Easter. It was kept as a church secret. No one outside of the church was allowed to see the music, and no one in the church was allowed to play it except in the Vatican at Easter. So if you wanted to hear that piece of music, you had to go to the Vatican and listen to it. This is an early version of copy protection. This is the same thing the music industry is sort of trying to do these days. It's trying to keep control over who can listen to music and where. Now, this obviously wasn't satisfactory to some people, and one year a young guy turns up at this Easter festival and listens to the music, and then he walked out and he wrote it down. Turns out this was Mozart. He was this good. He could actually do this. He could listen to a piece of music once and work out what the notes were and write it down. Unfortunately, most of us are not Mozart. Most of us can't in real time transcribe music or just listen to it and remember it and transcribe it, write it down. So it's helpful to be able to slow down the music. But I don't know, if you listen to records, if you play a record at the wrong speed or you play a tape at the wrong speed, you don't hear the same sound. What's happening is you slow down. When you slow down the sounds, you slow down the frequency. So if you halve the speed, you're going to halve the pitch. So if you want to be able to transcribe the music, you need some way of compensating for that. So there are various computer programs out there these days which will help you by taking a piece of music, slowing it down but correcting the pitch, so in theory it all sounds the same. So does it work well? You know, I don't tend to use this sort of transcription tools, so I don't know whether they're very good or not. I have a little tool for changing the way a piece of music is going to sound. We call this a vocoder. Recodes voice or recodes something. And I have a little piece of MATLAB. And what I've done is double the pitch. And you get something that generally sounds quite a lot sillier. It does distort the music a little bit. Still talking a bit about applications here. So what other applications are there for all of this sort of transforming stuff? Well, another classic application is what we call compression. Now, think about the amount of space a raw wave file takes. You take a CD and you take all of the contents of that CD and you put it on a computer disk. Well, a CD typically can store something like 700 megabytes of data. That's your 45 minutes of audio or your, you know, 50 minutes of audio. That's a lot of space to take up. Now you do that 20 CDs and you may have filled up your hard disk. Not a very convenient way of doing things. Disks are getting bigger these days. You still don't want to waste this space. The same is true with images. You take a 9 megapixel camera, 7 megapixel camera. That means it's got 7 million pixels. For each one of those pixels, your camera is recording a number that this tells you. It's actually recording three numbers, the red, green, and blue values. So even if they're only taking 1 byte each for those things, you're talking about 3 times 7, that would be 21 million bytes, 21 megabytes for an image. That's pretty unacceptable. You know, you take 1,000 pictures with your little digital camera these days, and that would take up a lot of disk space as well. So what do we do about that? Well, we do compression. There are various ways of doing compression. One of the ways is called lossless compression. And this is a technique which exploits redundancy in the signal. I'm not going to talk about lossless compression in this course. It's really a technique that's covered in courses like cryptography and coding. So if you want to have a look at that sort of thing, then I suggest you go away and sit in one of those sorts of courses. Some very, very clever and very powerful techniques. What I'm going to talk about in this course is what we call lossy compression. And the idea here is we give up on the idea of keeping a perfect version of our signal. We're going to let some of the data go. What data are we going to let go? Well, obviously we want to get rid of some data that doesn't really affect what we see very much or what we hear. There's a lot of material in, say, an audio clip which is not redundant in the information theory sense. There's information there, but it's not audible. So if there's all this redundancy, all this information there that's not audible or that we don't need, we could get rid of that and we could save ourselves a hell of a lot of space. And in fact, that's what MP3s do. That's what JPEGs do. They do this lossy compression where what you do is you take your signal and you get rid of some of it and you store some other bit. This gives you compression ratios which are rather a lot better for typical sorts of images and audio than lossless compression can be. But the trick is, how do we know which bits to get rid of? How can we work out what bits aren't going to be important? Well, if we look at the signal in the frequency domain, it's much, much easier to work out which bits of the signal are not all that important to your ear. Your ear can't hear signals above, say, 20 kilohertz. In fact, for most people, it's much worse than that. You may be talking about 15 or 10 kilohertz even being sort of the peak signals that you can actually hear. So if you've got sound information in that range, you could just get rid of it altogether. It wouldn't matter. Likewise, when we have sounds that are, you know, relatively outside of our audible range at the lower end, you could get rid of them. There's all these sorts of examples, but actually compression techniques are a bit more sophisticated than that, and we'll talk about JPEG in particular in detail in a few lectures. So there's another thing that we can do with them. Another thing that you might want to do is acoustic fingerprints. So what do I mean by this? Well, imagine a computer which was trying to work out what song it had just heard on the radio. So this is an application that I think there's a company now that sells. You know, what you can do is type in the radio station you're listening to, and try and find out what song they've been playing. I mean, one of the irritating things about the radio is you turn it on halfway through a song and you think, oh, that was a really nice song. And the announcer never bothers to tell you because he told you what the song was at the start. So you never find out what song that was. And maybe you never hear it again. So how would you find that out? Well, you know, you could go and ask a friend, or you could go and, you know, to a record store and say, try humming a bit of it, and maybe they'll be able to tell you what it is. But it would be nice to have this computer application which just works out what those songs are. How's it going to do that? Well, it's going to look up the song in a database. But if you took all of the songs in the world, all the, you know, tens of thousands of songs in the world, and you stored the full song in a database, not only would that database be absolutely huge, but also the time to look through that whole database looking for a match would be incredible. So what you really need is some way of fingerprinting it. Think of this as a way of identifying your piece of music, taking a fingerprint from it, and then looking through that fingerprint database instead of the whole database, instead of the whole song. You know, this is what the FBI do with their fingerprint database. They go and look for people's fingerprints. They don't go and look for the whole person in the database. That would be kind of awkward. So acoustic fingerprints could be useful for this. But it's a rather challenging application, because when you think about it, these fingerprints have to be robust to a whole lot of things. When you play a song over the radio, you get a whole lot of noise added to it. That's bad. Maybe the song was compressed. So remember I said when we're doing our compression, we chuck some of the information away. Now that would be bad if our fingerprint relied on that information, because then we just lost the fingerprint. You know, sometimes you come to a song halfway through. So how do you deal with that? Well, one of the ways that's been proposed, and there's a couple of patents that I had a quick look at, which suggests how to do this is to transform the signal into the frequency domain and look for your fingerprints in the frequency domain. This gives you some robustness to certain sorts of problems in the music. For instance, it doesn't care how far through the song you are, because remember, the Fourier transform, you lose all sense of time. You might lose some information, but that's like adding some noise to the signal. And you know we're already adding noise to it. The Fourier transform might be a bit more robust to some forms of noise. So doing our fingerprinting in the Fourier domain after we've done our Fourier transform might also be a really good way of going about it. I don't think this is a really solved problem though. I think there's a couple of recent patents on ways of doing it, but I think there could be a lot of research on, you know, how to do it a bit better. Maybe an idea for a project. Of course, we can do integral transforms in higher dimensions. The one that we're going to look at is just two dimensions, but you can do it in three or four or five or six dimensions. There are a whole bunch of these sorts of transforms. For instance, the Radon transform, the 2D Fourier transform. This is just a generalization of the 1D Fourier transform, the Hankel transform, and so on. Why would we want to do any of these? Well, let's have a quick look at the Radon transform and see what it does, and maybe you'll get an idea. The 2D Fourier transform is a pretty direct analogy to the 1D Fourier transform. We're going to talk about that in lectures. Let's have a quick look at the Radon transform, though. What does the Radon transform do? Well, the Radon transform is a transform that we typically use for doing image processing, image analysis. And the thing that we use it to do is detect lines in an image. So imagine you have a picture of your house and you want to do some sort of computer analysis of that house. Well, houses tend to be made up of straight lines. So what we want to do is pull those straight lines out of the picture and work out where they are. Well, that's a non-trivial thing to do in general, but the Radon transform really helps us. And how does it work? Well, this is the transform. This is a delta function. Dirac delta functions, we're going to come across these a lot during this course. The Dirac delta function, it's not really even a function. We'll talk about this a little bit more a little bit later, but it doesn't really take something and map it to a value. We can think crudely about it, a delta function, as a function that does something. Let's see if I have a texture. It looks something like this. This is S, this is delta T minus S. So it's zero everywhere except at this point. That's a kind of weird idea, zero everywhere except at that point. And it's kind of a spike here. One way of thinking of these is a limit of a series of functions that look like this. Start with a function like this, then go with a function like this, then like this, and they get narrower and narrower and taller and taller. We don't really say it takes a value of infinity though, because that's not the point. The point of a delta function is that if I integrate over a delta function, so say I integrate f of t delta t minus s, what it does is it sifts out the value of the delta. So you can see I'm integrating over t, this is t minus s, it sifts out the value of f of s. This is the basic property of a delta function that we exploit here. So what does it do here? Think about what this is. This is actually the equation of a straight line. This is my straight line here. Rho is the normal distance to the origin, and theta is this angle here. So this is a parametric form of the equation of a straight line. So what's this guy going to do? Well, I'm taking some function over a space. Think of an image, x and y, are the x and y directions in my image, and I'm integrating over a delta function where the delta here is a straight line. So for some particular rho and sigma, what it will do is extract the straight line out of this function. It's an integral, so what it actually does is it integrates along this line through the image. Why is that a useful thing to do? let's have a quick look. This is going to be my image. Imagine I have a point in my image and a line. Remember, when we do this guy, this corresponds to a line. So this line here will correspond to a point. And this is the, well, it's been truncated down here a little bit. This is rho down here. So this is rho here, this is theta here. So take a line here, and it gets transformed to a point in this image. A point rho theta. If I take a point in this image, there are a whole bunch of lines that can go through that. So for each of these lines, I will get a point in this space. So what the transform does is it takes a point and it transforms it to a kind of curve in my radon space. Likewise, if I have another point, it gets transformed into a curve. Another point gets transformed into a curve. Another point gets transformed into a curve. You notice something that's happening here. All of these points, all of these curves here are overlapping at a point. That point corresponds to this black line, again. So what does the radon transform do? Well, the radon transform takes lines in this image and transforms them to a point here. So imagine this was an image where each of these points had a value, a brightness. And imagine that along this line there were a whole lot of bright points. When I sum them all up by this integral and do the transform, I'd end up with a very bright point here. And all of these points here would have some, there'd be something there, but they overlap here. So this guy would sum up and give you a really bright point. Here's an example. So this is an image. The yellow points are the bright points, the large values. You can see I have these two lines here, and you can see that there's two points in the transformed image, and they correspond to the line. So this gives me a very general technique of extracting these lines out of this image. You might say, why not do least squared regression? Isn't that how we find straight lines, if you've done any statistics at all? Well, there's a few problems with least squared regression. Firstly, regression really assumes there's one line. Look, I've got two lines. How do I do regression to find two lines? Well, maybe you could look at how to do it. It's a bit tricky. The other thing is, you notice there are bright points all through this image. The unique thing about these is there's a whole bunch of bright points here. But there's a bright point down here. Least squared regression is very sensitive to outliers. This point down here, this brighter point down here, would be an outlier. It would tend to distort the shape of the line away from its real position. So having these lines here and transforming them with the radon transform gives us a nice generic sort of technique for trying to solve this detection problem. I've gone through that reasonably quickly. We'll talk a bit more about radon transforms a bit later in the course, because they're also useful for doing things like tomography. What other transforms are there? Well, you pick a kernel function, any kernel function you like, and someone's come up with a transform that uses it. There are many, many transforms that people generally named after people. I'm not going to talk about most of these. It's pretty easy to find information about them if you need to use them for some particular reason. I'm going to be really restricting my attention to this bunch up here. And in fact, I'm actually not going to talk much about Laplace-Dieuchy's or Fourier-Dieuchy's transforms. The Fourier-Dieuchy's transform is a nice simple, well, not simple, nice generalization of the Fourier transform. Not a big deal. We could do it if we had a bit more time. The Laplace transform and Laplace-Dieuchy's transform, another big class of transforms, very, very useful, very interesting. The reason I don't tend to look at it much in this course is that I found in the past that most of the students have had at least an introduction to Laplace transforms. And so spending a lot of time on them doesn't seem worthwhile, particularly given we want to get to wavelet transforms by the end, and the Fourier transform is going to get us there. So I spend a bit more time on Fourier transforms, We do talk a little bit about Zetralstons along the way, not a great deal. We're mainly focused on trying to get to wavelet transforms at the end of the course. There are simple relationships between various of these transforms. I have listed a few of them here. I'll talk about these when they come up. I'm not going to try and list all of the possible transforms that and their relationships here. There are a bunch of interesting relationships though, and we'll get to them when we get to the things in the course. I want to quickly go over one other idea that's going to come up again and again in the course, and that's the idea of a basis of a set. Now, to be honest, I'm not going to cover this stuff very rigorously, and I'm going to use the term basis in a pretty loose sense. So I apologize to those of you who like mathematical rigor. What I want to do is get across a few sort of intuitive ideas about bases and what we're doing here, rather than trying to, you know, cover everything in the utmost detail. So when we talk about a basis, we're talking about trying to represent a function in terms of some other set of functions. So this would be the sort of thing I mean. We have a function here, and I want to represent it as some linear combination of what we call our basis functions. Call it a weighted sum. Sometimes we do this as an integral. The integral we can just see is the continuous generalization of this discrete sum. Now, the simplest case would be to use these old delta functions that we have here. Remember, I just wrote this property of the delta functions here, so I put a delta function in here. I'm just going to get, when I do this integral, I'm just going to get f of t out the other end. What am I saying? What am I trying to unclearly convey to you? Well, the point is, when you write a function, when you draw a function on the board, or when you draw a plot of it, or you know, write cosine of t, we naively think that's the function. It's not the function. It's a representation of the function. It's a way of writing down the function. It's telling you the values of the function at certain points is like telling you this thing, where you have a delta function here. You never really get to the real function, at least not in the sort of analysis that I'm going to do here. We're always looking at these representations of it. Think of these functions as abstract objects in some space. Then you're starting to get to the sort of basic idea of what those functions are. As soon as you draw your function, you're telling me something about it. You're telling me some sort of representation of that function. And as soon as you do that, there's this sort of implicit notion that there's some sort of basis there. Typically, when we draw it on a board or something, there's this basis which is from the identity transform. So what are transforms doing in all of this? Well, things like the Fourier transform just correspond to a change of basis. All we're doing is we're changing the representation. So we go from a function space where we have these deltas to represent our function. So imagine we have, let me draw another picture quickly. This is my function. Think of it as a bunch of deltas going out to each point and telling me where those points are. Another way of representing that function is to tell me it's a cosine or it's a sum of two cosines. Then I'm representing it in terms of cosine functions. How do I do that? How would I work out that representation? Well, the way you do that is you use the Fourier transform. Fourier transform tells you that new representation. So it represents a change of basis. Again, this is an introductory lecture, so I'm going through things kind of roughly and fast. We'll come across this concept again and again, though. One example that you should have seen before is a simple example from first year linear algebra. So if you can't cope with this, go back and have a look at your first year math linear algebra notes, because this shouldn't be hard. So whenever we write a vector, we're really writing it as, so this is my vector, we're really writing it as a weighted sum of basis vectors. So if I write a vector, 1, 2, 3, what I'm really writing is 1 times E1 plus 2 times E2 plus 3 times E3. Well, those are my unit basis vectors for R3. That's what I've written here. This is one of my unit basis vectors for R3. When we do any sort of linear transformation, what we're really doing is multiplying by a matrix. Remember, we're interested in linear transformations here. We're doing linear integral transforms. Linear, the discrete equivalent of that is just multiplication by a matrix. When we do that, what we can do is change the basis. So now we can represent our vector in terms of a different set of basis functions. So for discrete signals, this is all you have to know. Discrete signals are just vectors. Most of the signal processing we deal with is just vectors. And we deal with linear transformations of those vectors. So this is where I say the math that we're going to do is pretty easy. We're going to look at some continuous transforms through this course, and we have to know a bit of integration to do that because they're integrals. The discrete transforms, the applications mostly we're going to look at are just matrix multiplication of vectors. The math is almost trivial. We will branch into things that are a little bit more complicated as we go along, but only really at a superficial level. So here's my sets of integral transforms, and here's the basis functions that they correspond to. So the interesting ones are this delta function one, the identity transform, which is when we start with our original function. Then we do our Fourier transform, and the basis functions here are complex exponentials, which are sums of cosines and sines. I is the square root of negative 1. For those people who've done engineering degrees and regard J as the square root of negative 1, remember this is a math course. So we use I to mean the square root of negative 1. If we think about transforms in terms of the basis that we're transforming to, then the properties of those basis vectors or basis functions tell us a lot about what we're going to see, what it's going to tell us, what this transform is going to do. And there are a whole lot of properties here, and we'll talk a lot more about what these properties mean as we go through the course. And they relate directly to the properties of the transform. So very quickly, here are some sort of basic sorts of issues that we need to consider. Firstly, existence. Why existence? Well, particularly when we deal with integrals. Just because I can write down an integral on a piece of paper or the board doesn't mean it exists. It might be undefined. So we have to be a little bit careful about that, particularly with a Fourier transform where the integral is going to be from minus infinity to infinity. Typically, what we say is that the transform exists on some space, and we restrict the sort of functions that we can transform a little. We restrict them to some set of nice functions, functions that aren't too ugly, aren't too nasty in some sense. I'll be a bit more precise about that later on. We want to talk about various other properties. I might talk a little bit about some of these now, particular inversion. Two possible cases. So I have the two little stories. The frog prince, you've probably all heard the fairy tale of the frog prince. Basic idea, rich turns handsome prince into a frog, and he gets turned back into a prince when the princess kisses him. Okay, so this is an invertible transform. You don't lose anything. You transform the frog into the prince and vice versa. It seems to be fairly interchangeable. Obviously, one is preferable to the other. You can decide which. The other little example of a transformation, again, comes from Ovid's Metamorphoses. It's the story of Pygmalion. Pygmalion was a sculptor who, very good sculptor apparently, made a sculpture of a woman so good that he fell in love with his sculpture and wouldn't go out and see any other women or anything. And eventually he prayed to Aphrodite, and Aphrodite turned his statue into a real woman. So this is a transformation, at least in the story, that was irreversible. He got this real woman out of the end of it. What's the moral of the story? Well, you can work that one out for yourself. Okay, the point in our terms is for a transform to be invertible, it has to have a couple of properties. Firstly, we don't want to lose any information. If we lose information when we do the transform, then how are we going to do the inversion? Obviously we can't. It has to have some more technical properties as well to allow us to invert it. Most of the transforms that we're going to consider in this course are going to be invertible in some way or another. So for instance, the Fourier transform is invertible. And I think I'll have a class exercise for you to prove that. Well, by the way, one of the things that I should note in this course, in the class exercises, some of the problems will have an asterisk next to them. Those are problems that are only meant for the master students. If you're a fourth year or an honors student, you can still do that problem, and I might give you a bit of extra credit for it, but they're only compulsory for the master students. Okay, here's some inverses for the transforms that we already looked at. One of the things that is kind of interesting to notice is that if you look at our Fourier transform and its inverse, they look really similar. And this is pretty common, particularly where you have what we call an orthonormal basis. When the basis has a certain sort of property, then the inverse transform is going to look almost exactly the same as the forward transform. You see a bunch of our transforms and our inverses along here anyway. What else? Complexity. We're talking about signal processing here, so one of the things I definitely want us to think about is how you actually use these things in practice. You could give a nice math course which is just about the Fourier transform, but I want to talk about some real practical examples. When we deal with practical examples, the computational complexity is very important. Computational complexity tells us how many operations we have to do in order to perform our transform. Transforms that take too many operations are not going to be practical. One of the nice things about the Fourier transform is that even though in principle it looks like an order n squared transformation, if you do it directly, if you did it as a matrix product, for instance, on a discrete set of data, remember I said you can do our transforms as a matrix product. Well, that matrix for a data set of length n, the matrix would be an n by n matrix. So it's going to take at least order n squared operations to multiply. Actually, there are much faster ways of doing the Fourier transform. So the famous one is the Cooley-Tukey algorithm for doing the fast Fourier transform. And that's order n log n, which is much, much faster for large data sets. For the wavelets, there's a thing called a pyramidal filter bank, which is actually order n, which is really impressive. Given the wavelets is a much more general, much more powerful technique, I think, than the Fourier transform, the fact that we can do it even faster than the Fourier transform is kind of, it's a bit of fun. Bit more about sort of transform properties. Well, what are the key properties? I think, you know, when you come down to it, the key property is what does the transform do for you? So remember I showed you the radon transform. It highlights lines in an image. It pulls the lines out of an image. The Fourier transform pulls out frequencies. The short time Fourier transform, the spectrogram that I showed you earlier, or the pieces of music, that pulls out frequencies and times. It does it in a reasonably crude sort of way. The wavelet transform is a much stronger way of doing the same sort of thing. This property that they pull out is related to the basis function they use. Look at the basis functions here. The basis functions for the Fourier transform are cosines and sines. Lo and behold, when you do the transform, it tells you something about cosines and sines, the frequencies present in the signal. Okay, what aren't we going to talk about in this lecture, these lectures? Well, there's just a huge amount that we're not going to cover here. We only have 12 lectures. There's not enough time for us to do everything that I would like to do here. We're going to be talking primarily about digital signal processing when we talk about signal processing. We're not going to talk about analog devices. We will talk about continuous transforms a bit, because the math there tells us something interesting. Sometimes the proofs are easier with continuous transform than for discrete transforms and so on. But we're not going to talk about analog devices, devices that deal with continuous signals. Antennas, amplifiers, things like that, we're just not going to touch here. Why is that? Well, the primary reason is that digital signal processing is in some ways a much hotter topic. Courtesy of Moore's Law, digital devices get cheaper by roughly a factor of 2 every year, every 18 months. And so, as a result of this, digital devices, digital signal processing devices, are becoming much cheaper and much more practical at an exponential rate. And this makes them really interesting for a whole host of applications. We're not going to look at transform techniques for solving physical problems. So a classic example of this, the problem that Fourier himself actually worked on, was the heat equation. He was solving the differential equation that we now know, or we call the heat equation. And he used Fourier series to do this. We are not going to be doing that. We're not going to be trying to solve DEs using transform. You can. There are a whole bunch of really clever techniques for using various transformations to solve DEs. We're not going to touch them here. There are other courses that we teach around the place which go into those sort of techniques. There are a whole bunch of techniques we're not going to look into in a great deal of detail. I've already mentioned the fact we're not going to look at Laplace or the Steelchi's version of transforms. There are a whole lot of things related to wavelets, like wavelet packets, framelets, lifting schemes, and so on. Again, we're not going to go into all of them. We're going to stick to the basics. There's also a lot of other stuff that we, just not going to cover. There's just not enough time. You'll find probably when we get going into the course that we're tripping through material at a fairly fast rate. The other thing that I want to cover in this lecture is just a bit of basic notation. You should be familiar with most of this, I believe, already. But I want to make sure you know the notation. If you are not familiar with any of this stuff, really, really come and see me straight after this lecture, because you are going to have problems. So, standard complex numbers, my notation for real numbers is going to be these kind of curly R and I. Obviously, the real part takes the A out of here, the imaginary part takes the B. Complex conjugate, I'm going to use a little star for. The Hermitian conjugate, I'm going to use an H. And if you take the Hermitian conjugate of a matrix, remember, it's like taking the transpose and the complex conjugate of that matrix. Standard identities that we use from time to time, e to the ax equals cos plus I sine. Cos is half e to the ax plus e to the minus ax, likewise sine. So on. We use these trigonometric identities from time to time. Probably worth just doing yourself a little refresher on some of them. I tend to forget them all the time as well. Not a big deal, but you do need to know them in various places in this course. Some very simple signals that we will use from time to time in this course. Again, this is more in the line of trying to make sure that we have the same ideas. When I talk about something like a rectangular pulse, I mean this. When I talk about a unit step, I mean a step that goes up by one and it's sort of centered on the origin. When I mean my rectangular pulse, I mean centered around here. Sometimes people, when they talk about a rectangular pulse, they mean a pulse that starts at zero and goes for one unit or something like that. But I just want to make sure that we mean this when I talk about a rectangular pulse. And the sine function or sine function is like our step, but it goes from minus one to one. Again, simple notation. Delta function is not quite so simple. This is how we define it. We don't define it the way you define a function, because it's not really a function. It's what we call a functional. It's a more general class of thing than a function. Functions are special cases. Why is that? Well, all I'm telling you here is it's an even function. I'll tell you even in a second. When I integrate this function, I get my rectangular pulse, I get my step function. And when I integrate it over minus infinity to infinity with another function, it sifts out the value. So you see I've got a t naught here, Fish out the value of T naught, F of T naught. Okay. If you've seen delta functions before, you're probably quite happy to operate like this. If you haven't seen them before, you may have to think about this a bit. Do have a think about this. This property here is the critical one. It's a definitional property. I'm not going to try and derive it or something. This is part of what makes a delta function. And it's a property we're going to use again and again when we come to delta functions. So make sure you know this. We often draw a delta like this as an arrow going up because it doesn't really have a particular value. No defined value for the delta at this point. But we do say the delta is going to be zero for all of these other values. Otherwise, it can't satisfy this property. Likewise, this property also implies when you integrate over a delta function, you get one. So the unit, it's got a unit area underneath it, even though it has no real underneath. So this notion of limiting functions, we take a spike and we show, make it steeper and narrower. This is one way to think of how you get a delta function. These guys, though, these are all functions. When we get to that limiting case, it's no longer a function. It's this functional thing. So delta functions are a bit weird. We often call them Dirac delta functions, after Dirac, who was the guy who first used them. He's a physicist. Physicists tend to be very, sanguine about using these things without bothering to test the theoretical properties. I think it took mathematicians another 30 or 40 years before they believed that you could use delta functions, started using them themselves. So it's not a trivial thing. Do not feel, I mean, most of the other stuff I've been through today so far has been fairly trivial, fairly not a big deal. This delta function is a big deal. There's a lot going on here behind the scenes. If you don't understand what's going on, have a bit more of a think about it because it's important for us. Another function that we're going to come across from time to time is called the sinc function. It's defined like this. It's just going to be 1 when we get 0. Okay, little thing to point out to you guys, in your notes, when you get them, you notice these blocks are replaced by a minus sign. For some reason, my Macintosh doesn't like minus signs. So it puts little boxes there. So where you see these little boxes, generally it means there's a minus sign that's missing. But your notes, it should look fine in your notes. Don't know why it doesn't come up on here. Okay. Things to notice about the sinc function. Well, it takes the value 1 here by definition at 0. And then everywhere else, it's sine of x on x. There are various ways, again, that this gets defined. Sometimes it doesn't have the pi in it in the different books. I want to have the pi there. Why do I want to have the pi there? Well, you notice that it has zeros at 1, 1.5, 2, 2.5, so on, each of these points. That's because I have the pi there, otherwise it would be multiples of pi would have it zeros. Just makes it a bit easier for me to draw. It also links it up with the other notation I'm going to use a bit easier. There isn't, when we talk about these different definitions, one is not better than the other, but I want to give you a particular one so that we can be consistent about it as we go through these lectures. Properties of the sinc function, well, again, we integrate over the sinc function and we get 1, which is kind of nice. We integrate over a scaled version of it and we get 1 over a. What else is interesting about the sinc function? Well, we'll learn this fairly soon, I think, in the next lecture. The sinc function is the Fourier transform of the rectangular pulse. Remember this guy back here? We take the Fourier transform of this, and we get a sinc function. Again, this is an important thing for you to remember. If you go away after this lecture, and you try and remember one fact from this lecture, remember, the sinc function is the Fourier transform of the rectangular pulse. That's the one fact that I need you to remember, and I need you to remember that for the whole course. Signal characteristics, again we're back to easy things, an even function, an odd function, let me just give you a picture of them. This is an even function, the thing about an even function is if you reflect it around the y-axis, you get the same thing. So this point here reflects over to this point, and vice versa. Odd function, it reflects, but you also have to flip it this way. So if you reflect it and take the minus value, so this operation here is going to flip it in time, and this operation here is going to flip its value. Whereas here, you notice in my definition of an even function, I just flip it in time. What else? Well, we can always decompose a signal into an even and an odd part just by doing this operation. Hermitian. Hermitian is kind of a combination of the two. What does Hermitian mean? Well, when I flip it in time, when I take the signal at minus t, I get the signal at t, but I take a complex conjugate. What does that mean in practice? Well, you look at the signal in the, this is time along this axis, this is the imaginary axis, this is the real axis. The real value is symmetric. So the real value is even. The imaginary value, the complex part of it, is odd. It's anti-symmetric. So this is my Hermitian signal. What else have I got here? Periodic. Okay, this is a simple periodic signal. What does it mean? Well, it means that if I translate it some distance, nt, where t is the period, I get back my original signal. So this is a periodic signal. If I took this guy and I translate it by t, I get back my original signal. That's what we mean by a periodic signal. Obviously, a periodic signal is the sort of fundamental thing we're going to be working with here, so you have to know what periodicity is. You have to know what a period is. There's one trick here. Firstly, what's the period of this guy? Well, I could identify multiple values of t that work here. I can shift it like this, by t, or I can shift it like this, by 2t. What's the period? What's the thing I'm going to call my period? Well, we call the minimal value of t that satisfies this property the period. So the smallest value of t such that when you shift it by multiples of that t, it repeats itself. We call this the period. The frequency is 1 on the period. So in units, typically we measure period in seconds, although that depends on the application. When we're talking about sound, it might be seconds. When we're talking about an image, it's some sort of spatial measurement. Frequency, we typically measure in hertz. Hertz are cycles per second. But obviously, if we're not talking about seconds as our time unit or period unit, then it would be cycles per something else. We often also use, instead of frequency f, we use omega, which is 2 pi f, where we measure radians per second. And it's worth knowing this because sometimes in this course I will change between those two different sorts of notation. Trivial simple transformations, time reversal we've already seen. Time reversal, we just put a minus sign instead of a plus sign for t. Just means swapping the signal around in time. Take it and flip it around the y-axis. Time scaling, we're just going to scale the time variable. If we make a 2, that means stretching the signal out by 2. Have I got that the right way around? No, if I take A is 2, that's squeezing it down. Time shift, this just means taking the signal and shifting it one way or the other in time. Amplitude scaling means stretching it up or stretching it down in amplitude, just the value of the signal. Amplitude shift means shifting the signal up or down like this. And for complex signals, we can take various versions of our complex arithmetic. We can take the real part or we can take the complex conjugate. The magnitude is just going to be the square root of the real and the imaginary part squared. The phase angle is this angle between the two. And we can always write our complex signal as a magnitude plus e to the I times the phase angle.